Bob Gilgore, and it's October 13th in the year 2000, and I'm interviewing Hilliard Caldwell at his home at 1235 Hillsborough Street.
Good morning, Hilliard.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm well, and yourself?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I look forward to this interview. And my questions are going to be very broad kinds of questions, and I'd like you to just take them and go wherever you want with them. What I'd like to start with is if you could tell me what it was like growing up in Chapel Hill when you were a youth. And let's start with that.
Well, it most certainly was an unusual growing up period in a southern town, in particular in Chapel Hill Carver community. I have some very beautiful memories of my growing up. My family moved three or four times during my youthful days, from Rosemary Street to Merrick Mill Road, and of course finishing high school in 1956, at which time things were most certainly so-called equal, but segregated, but not equal, and I can attest to that. We had no automobile in our family, so it meant walking was a mode of transportation unless you went to Durham, and of course you drove there was a daily schedule to and from Durham from the Chapel Hill bus station, which is located on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill, and that too was segregated. There were the colored waiting room and the white waiting room. But the, and of course we, you know, being Afro-American, we were confined to our neighborhood and our community. When I lived on Merritt Mill Road and it was still going to the old Northside school, we, in a sense, passed a white high school and a white elementary school by way of Franklin Street. A lot of my classmates back in those days walked down to Church Street to go over to Northside, and that was a direct route. There were two or three other shorter routes to get to Northside. But, you know, I always thought during that time that you know, hey, this is, something is wrong with this process of us having to pass two white schools to get to our black school. But that's the way things were at that particular time, as I learned later on in life. Our family didn't have much, but our parents worked very hard to take care of six children. There were six boys in my family, an unusual family makeup, no sisters, and I've lost two brothers in the past 10 years, an older brother, the oldest, and a younger brother, the youngest, and there are four of us that are still living, one in New Jersey and the other three here in Chapel Hill, Carver. We worked hard. I remember many a days during my high school days working for families on Franklin Street. The one house in particular that I walked from Merritt Mill Road, which is my house was right near Lincoln Center, all the way down to where the right across the street from where the old public library is located, every Saturday morning to work for the there was a family, the old Lawson home place right there at the curve as you go down Franklin Street. It was Doc Lawson's home place. Estelle Page, Estelle's husband ran Ledbetter & Pickett for many years, Bob Page. It was his dad. His dad and mom lived in the old Lawson house. I'll never forget the family. And I went down and took care of the yard until it just got too cold to work outside on weekends, on Saturdays. And as I look back over those days as a youngster, I worked for 4 hours and we get $5 for those 4 hours. And back in those days, $5 for half a day work on Saturday was a large amount of money. I mean, it could go far. And I tell my kids today, you know, when they were growing up, they asked for money, and you know, you gave them $5 or $10 to do whatever they wanted to do. Back in our days, you had $5, and you could go to a department store downtown on Franklin Street and get two pair of pants for $5, $2.50 a pair. And I know during my years of growing up, I would come on after I made my money. I would come on back by a department store ran by a guy named Mr. Berman, and would get a pair of khakis and a pair of jeans, and it was about $5 and some tax cents, and that was great. You know, you new pair of pants, and then you'd save up enough to get you a pair of shoes back in those days, because with six brothers, it took a while before your time came around to get a pair of shoes, because the others ahead of you had to have, you know, shoes. And of course, I used to tell my son, with him being an only child, that when he needed shoes, we were able to take him to the store and get the shoes. You know, we didn't have to say, well, I can't get your shoes today. You got to wait and get Johnny's shoes tomorrow, and yours will have to come later. That was the difference then and now. Of course, during that time, salaries most certainly was a hell of a lot better for those of us who had darn good jobs back in those during the time our children was growing up here.
Can you tell me about your family and your extended family? Who was here to give you support?
Well, my mom most certainly is the person that I put on the pedestal. Who got me through, and I always would say, if you just help me get through high school, you won't have to worry about me. And of course, R.D. Smith, who is still here in the community, was a person within the school system who took me under his wings and said, by God, I'm going to make something out of you, because I see a lot of potentials. And today, I give credit to R.D. for my succeeding in high school, to my mom and to R.D. And then after high school, R.D. was still there to give me the guidance. And of course, he was responsible for advising me to run for public office in 1980. And of course, my political career is history now, having ran for public office in 1980 and got elected to a four-year term in the town of Carver on the Board of Aldermen. And went through that process four times, from 1980 to 1990 to the year 2000, serving four terms, which was a total of 16 years. And it's a record that I'm very proud of. And again, R.D. Smith was that person, was that driving force behind me running for public office, because I was president of my student body at Lincoln High in 1955-56. And that was the first time that I'd ever ran for an office where people voted for you based on what you stood for. And having experienced that in a all-black high school was the driving point in getting me to want to run for public office for people, you know, for citizens out in the community. I'm very proud of the record that I established during 16 years on the Carver Board of Aldermen.
I would like to get into that later on. Did both of your parents work?
Well, my father went away to the war and was killed in World War II. And so that left five brothers for my mom to raise. She subsequently married again, and there was another brother. Work back in those days was, for my mom, was as they used the word, domestic workers. Back then, she worked for several families in town. And the thing that always, that I look back over, how in the world did she feed five children? And we were fed, we ate well. We didn't have steaks, fatback meat, or you all might know it as side meat. Was our staple. We had hamburgers and chicken, and fish. And I'll never forget, my mom somehow got hooked on something called salt herrings. And she used to send us to the store to get that. And it was fish that was, the stores kept them in a crock pot, a big old tall crock pot, and it was in salt brine. And they had more bones than I said, Lord, if I ever get to be an adult, I will never eat another fish with bones in it. And of course, after I married my second wife, and she introduced me to catfish, that's all I eat now, is because there's no bones, you know, after they're filleted, they're 99.9% boneless. But, oh, I hated salt herrings when my days were growing up. But that was food, and I had to eat it, you know.
What kind of income did your mom have? Must not have made a whole lot of money.
Back in those days, as I can recall, no, you're right, they did not make a whole lot of money. I think, you know, $25 to $35 a week might have been top wages back in those days. You know, during that time, we as children were not privileged to monies as it came into the household, particularly by the parents. I'm just assuming, based on what I can remember, it's about $25 or $30 a week. I remember her last working years was at a fraternity house, and of course I had gotten grown and was married, and I think the pay was a hell of a lot better, plus there was plenty of food that they could bring home, you know, leftovers. And I remember many a days when I would go pick her up to bring her home, and she would have wrapped up packages of meat for me and my wife and my son back in those days. And it was a livable salary based on the times. You know, they didn't make a whole lot of money. So as a result of that, you know, they were not privileged to invest like, you know, you and I did when we were working. We were, in later years, I know we were introduced in investments about 25 or 30 years ago. And we did so. And of course, you know, today, year 2000, it's paying off for those of us that are retired.
Did mom work 7 days a week, or did she?
It was more 5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And I remember those days, if Thanksgiving was on a weekend, she had to go in and help serve the food for the white family's gathering. And I remember many occasions she would take one of us with her. And it was always a joy for me because I knew we would get, you know, we would be able to take home a lot of food from the gathering.
What kind of values did you think your mom gave you? You put her on a pedestal, and I'd like to get into why she was there and what you got from her in the way of values.
Well, I think my mom was from a large family herself, and her mom and dad instilled values. As I can recall, the history of my grandparents, they were Baptist ministers, and they were very involved in the Baptist Church from the Afro-American community standpoint. And it was tradition that children obeyed, that children you didn't talk back, you obeyed your parents, you obeyed everyone in the community, the adults in the community, and everyone in the church. And so it was instilled into us as children that we should do the same thing, because the next door neighbor had just as much power over me as my mom did. And I look back over those days, and I appreciated the lady next door, the lady down the street, correcting me when she saw me do something wrong. And you pray to God that they didn't say anything to your mom about it, because you'd get it again, you know. And they could say something to you, and they could chastise you for what you did, or send you home. And I remember many a days, neighbors used to say, would call your name. If you can't act nice here, then you need to go home. You know. Now you say that to a child, and you go home and you tell your mom, children go home and tell their mom, well, Miss Jones said if I couldn't act nice, I couldn't come to her house anymore. Instead of that parent taking that as a, what is the word?
An affront, a personal insult?
Yeah, instead of her taking it that way, calling her, thanking you so much for correcting Jimmy. I found out what he said. I'm going to make sure he gets punished home. You don't see that today. So the value, and my mom used to say, carry yourself. I never forget this, and it took me years to understand. She would say, carry yourself so that when you walk down the street as an adult, people can say, there go one of Irene Caldwell's sons, and that's Hilliard. He's the one that works for the school system, or he's the one on the Carver City Council. And my oldest brother was an honor taker. He worked in the funeral home business for years. And she instilled, she said, when I'm gone, I want my name to linger around for years that I raised you all right. And I was always respectful of all adults. And today I still refer people that are, when I had supervisors that was younger than I was in, in my jobs, I would say, yes, ma'am, no, sir, yes, sir. And today I find myself saying it to people, and they'll say, oh, call me, like you said, was it day before yesterday, you said, call you Bob. And the guy that's going to rent our house called me last night, and I kept calling him Mr. Gossel, and he said, call me John. And I said, well, this is just part of my training. I just respect you as an adult. And that was part of my training back then. And I instill that into my son. And when he came along, and I would, particularly when he was in the school system, and I would go to the school for whatever reason, and the teacher would say, oh, Hilliard, I met your son, Steve, and he is the most manable student I've ever met. And that makes you feel good as a parent.
Makes you feel proud.
You better believe it.
Did you have aunts, uncles, grandparents nearby?
Didn't remember my grandparents. Wished I had. Today, a dear friend of my late mom retired back here, and some years ago, my late wife and I hooked up with her, and I refer to her as my god grandmother, and it's a good feeling having her there because she and my late mom were the best of girlfriends back in those days when they were young. My mom had a brother and a sister here, and they've many years now since been gone on. My mom's sister and her husband didn't have any children. Her brother had a daughter who now lives in Atlanta, and we stay in touch with each other as first cousins. In fact, my wife and I just went up to Asheville this past weekend to visit my aunt. And when I'm with her, I think of the old days, my uncle. I used to go to him, particularly when I was in high school, and if I needed some money for a particular project at school, he would, I could go to him and get it. When I would take the money back to repay him, he would refuse to take it. So, I always say, he contributed to my getting out of high school. There were times when, there's a project and you needed $5 to pay for this or $3 for that, and if I didn't have it, I could go to him. And that's right today. I respect his wife, who's still living, there's a widow living in Asheville. And I have some fond memories of him when I go see her. I have two brothers that are still living here in Chapel Hill. The other members of the older members of the Caldwell family have, since then died out. And there's a new generation of younger members of the family coming along.
What was your neighborhood like when you grew up?
Dirt roads, muddy streets when it rained. I don't remember. I remember we always had water and bathrooms, as I can recall. And my wife and I tease each other today about those things when we were growing up. And there was a family that I got to know when I was about 10, 11, and 12 years old, that I used to go stay with out in Chatham County. It was a black family, got to know them. And they had outdoor bathroom facilities. And that's the only one thing I can remember of outdoor facilities. But we always rented, I never forget that. And the streets were dirt. Merritt Mill Road was dirt road when I was in middle, junior high, and high school. Very few homes had running water in the north side area, and all that ended, those who didn't, that ended when Howard Lee became the first mayor of Chapel Hill. And the first thing he did was to get streets paved in the north side area. And see, the north side area is considered from Rosemary Street all the way back to behind old north side, where the mental health clinic and north side complex is now. That's considered north side. From Sunset Drive, right as you enter Carver on Rosemary Street, all the way down to Columbia Street, behind the old homeless shelter, down back to that was considered as the old north side community. And when Howard came on board, there was a lot of houses in that area that did not have running, that had water, but not bathrooms. And very few of the streets were paved. And there was a lot of open ditches with large water, when it heavy rain, water would, what they call that, rainy weather creeks. And all this water running off in Franklin Street somehow went down through Mitchell Lane on out through behind North Side back over into that area. And the kids didn't have many toys to play with. Like the kids today have got, you know, bicycles, scooters, and all of the up-to-date things that kids, you know, I know those scooters that you see now. My god-grandson is asking for a scooter. And when I saw the price of the cheapest one running about $70 or $80, and that was the cheap kind, the more expensive kind with the hand brakes or the brakes on the back of the wheel. Paying that kind of money back in my days, my own son, who's 35, 36 today, he's out in my shop. He's got mini bike, 3.5 horsepower mini bike sitting back there right now. And he had all kinds of bicycles when he was growing up. The regular bicycle, the 2-speed, the 5-speed, you know, as they got modernized, he got one. And I got to pack up Tonka trucks now that he had when he was coming along. So we didn't have that kind of stuff. We used to take an old bicycle wheel, an old tie, and that was one of our toys, running up and down the road with an old tie off in a car. An old bicycle rim that we would play with. We would improvise. I don't know how we did it, but we improvised those days and survived. So
it sounds like the community helped raise you.
The community raised a lot of children back in my days.
In church?
You were in Sunday school every Sunday. I tell you, my mom would, and her philosophy is, if you don't go to Sunday school, you don't play, you stay in the house on Sundays. And that was a free day from school, Saturdays and Sundays. Saturdays you spent, in my days, we spent cutting wood, because we would order wood by the cord, slabs from sawmills. And then we'd have to cut it, because you heat it by wood and you cook by wood. So me and my brother spent Saturdays cutting up wood. We'd cut enough wood, we'd get out there early on the morning, Saturday morning, we'd cut 5 or 6 hours.
Hilliard, can you tell me about the relationships with whites, with sports or school or extracurricular work?
We didn't have contact with the white counterparts in our days growing up was rare. And at this point, I need to give credit to the late Charlie Jones, who started out in Chapel Hill as minister of the Chapel Hill Presbyterian Church on Franklin Street. And, you know, as you can recall, Charlie ended up being minister of the community church. You know, he was ousted at the Presbyterian Church because he housed a group of black ministers that came through the area traveling somewhere and they needed somewhere to stay, and he put them up in his church congregation. Members of the congregation didn't like that, but Charlie stood out and made a bold statement that, you know, they were ministers and they were his brothers in Christ. Charlie Jones was the first person to bring a group of us high school students together, and we met at the YMCA on campus. And I'll never forget, the director of the Y campus at that time was a lady, and I can't even remember her name now. She's since retired up near the mountains. But Charlie Jones had a daughter that was a junior at the same time, and he pulled together a group of black high school students and students from the white high school, and we met on campus at the YMCA, and we had a dialogue for approximately 2 years, and I would give anything to find those tapes of our meetings. That was my first involvement with white students. But prior to that, we didn't go to their games. I know I didn't go to any of the white high school games. We all played. At that time, there was a park in Carver on Fidelity Street called the Carver Lions Park. And they had created an athletic field there with bleachers and everything, and concession stands. And that's where our high school would play our football games. And we would have lots of whites who would attend our game, because every year our football team from Lincoln High School or Orange County Training School, the original high school here, would end up in a championship. And so we had good football players. Same thing with basketball players. But as far as interacting, I did not know any white kids until my junior year in high school. We'd see each other. They'd pass us on the school bus. We'd be walking to the Northside School from Merrick Mill Road, and we'd see them, and they'd be going to school, but there was no interaction, none whatsoever. And that was the way things were back in those days here in southern, you know, Chapel Hill, Carver. And most certainly didn't take place in Carver, because Carver was considered I wouldn't call Carver a racist town, because I think my being elected in 81 would tell you that that most of the citizens in Carver had gone beyond that mentality of no blacks involvement with blacks, because I was elected by a good example of that was my election to the city council here, the Board of Aldermen, by the community, and I most certainly needed the white vote to get elected. So the your question was, the involvement was very rare back in those days.
What was the relationship of the black community with a police, with the government, with the UNC?
At UNC, we worked there. That was a predominant source of employment for members of the Afro-American community in Chapel Hill, Carver.
What did you do? What kind of work?
Well, you worked in housekeeping on main campus, and when the hospital came on board, you worked in housekeeping there, or you worked in the kitchen, or you worked in the dining halls on campus, or you worked in fraternity houses. You were maids out in the private community, and those who worked for permanent families. Back in those days, you know, and I'm trying to think of some, we had a congressman from Chapel Hill for a long time, a guy named Carl Durham, lived out on Franklin Street, a big old beautiful brick house on the left there as you round the curve. And there was other permanent families, white families. If blacks worked for those families, they were considered, you know, doing pretty good, because those families picked them up and brought them to the house, and they made, as I can recall, you know, not a decent salary, but a salary, their kids that I remember that were friends of mine seemed to have had good, you know, nice clothes. You remember there was those kids in your class who had nice clothes, and you were just barely making it. that was the jobs. I remember during the time we were demonstrating in the early 60s, a lot of Afro-Americans did not participate in the demonstration because they had been warned by the people they worked for on campus that if you, you know, Johnny, now you know I'm your supervisor here and housekeeper, it's always white supervisor, and you know you shouldn't be out there marching downtown. And a lot of them didn't do it. And there were those of us that were brave. And in the early 60s, I worked for the university in the Department of Medicine with Bill Blythe and Chris Fordham. Well, those guys were liberal. You know, Bill and Chris Bowe were North Carolinians by birth. I know Bill was from up near the mountains. And of course, Chris Fordham and his family was originally from Greensboro. Well, Lou Welt, who was chair of the department at the day, was from up New Jersey, and he was very sympathetic to the calls, civil rights calls in this community. And he gave me and a couple of guys that worked for him, he said, you know, as long as it doesn't interfere with your work, you have my support. In fact, the night I was arrested, he called my wife and said, I'll be too glad to go as bond if need be.
That's pretty good support.
Yeah, very good support from the liberal white community. I need to put the word liberal in it because I distinguish those. And there might have been more who wanted to help, but just didn't. You know, Joe Straley, Wayne Bowers, these guys were professors. I know Wayne and Joe both were in the Department of Physics. They were full professors. People in my Department of Medicine gave us their moral and financial support. You know, they weren't out there on the firing line like Joe Straley and Charlie Jones and those guys were.
Was Charlie Jones the one who housed Marian Anderson when she came through also?
Probably so, knowing Charlie, knowing things back the way he probably so. I was not aware of that history.
What about the black community's relationship with the police department?
Now in Carrboro, that was a different thing. I've been told many tales about what happened in Carrboro, that you were not seen in Carrboro after 6 o'clock on the street. Because back in those days, the policemen that they hired were old redneck guys from the community, had no training, no human relations training. It was not good to get arrested by a white policeman in Carrboro. And that was because the mentality of the chief at that time and the mentality of the men that was hired. And of course, thank God that's not the case today, not around here. They still might do that in some of the old southern towns deeper south, where you worked at a service station, particularly a white boy, you worked at a service station and you knew somebody who was on the police force and you dropped out of school and they had a vacancy and you wanted to be a policeman, then you was hired as a policeman. The tales of Carver was told to me by people who remember those days. When we were coming along, we were very bold. I remember going to the Carver Police Department several times on some incidents when things were still segregated, and it was not a good feeling going there because. Your story most of the time was you didn't get any support, you know, and as the years went by, the police department became a little bit more as they hired chiefs of police who had some background training in human relations. Things started getting a little better.
When did this business of not being out on the street after
again, this was tales that was passed on down to us by other blacks in the community.
So this was what, in the 30s, 40s?
30, you know, 40s, 50s. See, the early 60s, I lived in Carver in the early 60s. I was very active in the civil rights movement. Did you ever read the book Free Men? And that's a book that you should read that will give you a beautiful Free Men by John Ely.
I just bought a book on the black movement in the United States.
Mm. Yeah. friend of mine just found a copy of this book in a bookstore up in New York somewhere on the internet. I know the libraries at both campus and Chapel Hill has it in their collection. Free Men by John Ealy. John Ealy was a local writer, I mean a North Carolina writer, lives up in Winston-Salem area.
What was it like at the high school, at Lincoln High School when you were there? Is that a positive experience for you?
Very much so, because our faculty and administration was very, you know, much into your welfare, being you a student. Many a days I would ask Mr. McDougall, the late Mr. McDougall, whom McDougall Middle School and the elementary school is named after, he and his wife both, who spent many years in the educational system here, I would ask, you know, why we don't have this. I remember we had a chemistry lab that was built as part of the new school, but we never had a chemistry teacher, you see, so we had all this apparatus there. And we never had anybody until later, after I left high school, that we did a, I remember they hired a black guy named Mr. Christmas, that was his last name, who was a combination biology chemistry teacher. And I would have given anything to have taken a course in chemistry when I came through high school, because I thought chemistry was so fascinating. I had, my mom bought me a chemistry set when I was a ninth or tenth grader. And I remember doing the experiments that was part of that set. I think set cost about $10 or $11, you know. And I was just fascinated at what I could do with the little chemicals that came with that set. And the White High School most certainly had more courses than we had, more courses that that would lead one into going to a four-year school, you know, college after high school. I valued my high school teachers. I will put my high school teachers up against any teacher today. And I was just talking this past weekend, a friend of mine came by, we were talking about an English teacher that we all had that came along during that time, named Miss Turner. And Miss Turner was so strict when I would do a paper, and it would come back so red that it would just make you ashamed. And she said, "I want this paper done over again. I know you, young man, can do better." Take the paper, you take it home that night. You sat there and you spend many hours redoing that paper. And we didn't have typewriters, we didn't have computers. And Lord, I had the worst handwriting in the world, still have. But our teachers, and our PTAs, when we had PTA meetings at our high school, the parking lot was packed with cars, for those who had cars. The auditorium where we had the meeting was packed. The parents would walk to from Northside, way over by where the old Northside building is now, all the way to Lincoln to get to PTA meetings. And when we had a drive for band uniforms or football uniforms, parents, they worked their behinds off. Because that was their school, and they felt that they had a say so in that school environment. I know one of the things I did when I first came on board was to spend time doing PTA meetings, encouraging parents to go to, you know, to go out to PTA meetings. It's your school too, and I don't know, I think a lot of parents back after integration became part of the norm, felt that the whites had already talked about what was going to take place. And by the time they got involved in it, it was moot. That happened a lot around here, and I'm sure it happened all over the South. I know I was the first president, black president of Cobbler School PTA, way back when my son came through. And what we did, we established a system where the president would be black and the vice president would be white, and we rotated it during my son's sixth grade, 6 years at Cobber, and it worked out for a beautiful PTA. I know when I came on board as president, there was no money in the PTA treasury. When I left for about $600 or $700 for the next person, you know, because we had fundraising, and by being a black president, with my agenda. Parents attended PTA meetings, cooperated. Parents, blacks, become leaders within their child's class as grade mothers. Today, I don't know what the situation is now. I've been away from the system since 90, an active member of the system since 92. I know at McDougal Middle School, where I worked part-time for the past 6 years, I made many phone calls encouraging blacks to come to PTA meetings, because I let them know it was very important that you be involved, and did encourage some to become leaders within the PTA.
What percentage of the students from Lincoln High when you were there went on to college, would you guess? I know you don't have exact numbers.
Let me take my own high school class, the class of 56. There were a large percentage of us who went out to college the first year we were out of high school, but because of family finances, we couldn't go back. We didn't have the monies to go back. And I look at my own class, and there were about 40 of us in our class, small class. I would think about 10 to maybe 10 went on and successfully finished college. Those of us who didn't finish were lucky enough to get a good job. We were at the right place at the right time. I know I'm a good example. You know, I never finished college, but ended up being, had a excellent job with the school system, created a reputation for myself within the system and the community, and go on to get elected in the city government, and is still highly respected. People tell me that you still carry a lot of your voice is listened to around, and you still carry a lot of weight. I don't want to look at it as I still carry a lot of weight. I just appreciate people having respect for me, black and white. Finance back in those days was a hard commodity among black students in the South in particular. And so those of us who finished our first year at college, we came back, and luckily I had a friend who was working for the Department of Medicine, and he called me and said, "We've got a vacancy. Are you interested in applying?" And I said, "Yes," and I did, and got hired, 58. And as a result of that, I spent 35 years under the state system, and you know, I'm now, you know, retired under the state system with a nice.
What was the position on?
It was at the Department of Medicine, as a research technician, and I ended up my career with them as chief technician with the dialysis program in the Department of Medicine.
Now, how did they know you?
A friend of a classmate had worked in that research lab, and he knew. He called me because he was looking for somebody dependable, somebody who would come to work every day and who would learn, wanted to learn. And that's what I did. My mom said, whatever situation you go into, job, learn all you can. Then she always said, don't pretend to know everything. And even if you know everything, pretend you don't. Ask lots of questions and show interest in every facet of this job. And I did, every job I went into. You know, some people come to a job knowing everything, and they can in turn turn off people. I never asked for a raise. I never asked for a promotion. They always came to me. I was very grateful, you know, for that.
So your first job was before immigration.
Mm-hmm.
What was the atmosphere like with this integration pending? Laws passed, I assume,
well,
at that time?
They were being passed. They were being discussed. And you sat in the back of the bus from here to Durham. There was a white line. You were behind that line. You went into they used the word colored. Even up to 63, Memorial Hospital still had white signs on bathrooms and colored signs, and they had white water fountain and colored water fountain. 1963, that was the year my son was born. The OBGYN wards were still segregated in 63, because I'll never forget When my wife, when we were told the due date, I went to the hospital and demanded that my wife be given a room on the white OBGYN ward. And she was given that, 1960, March of 1963.
Did they integrate at that time, mm-hmm. after March 63?
Mm-hmm. They sort of put in. I'll never forget the guy, the OBGYN doctor, his name Dr. Charles Flowers, beautiful guy in the Department of OBGYN. And he handled my wife's pregnancy and the delivery. I went to the director of admissions in January and said, my wife is due March the 27th, and I don't want her put in a ward. At that time, the 4OB was for Afro-Americans and 5 was for whites. The fifth floor had private rooms. Every room up there was private for private mom. I wanted my wife in one of those private rooms. And when we came in that night, the room was already assigned to her. And that's where our son was born. And the next morning, word got out that there was a black mom on 5OB, and people from all around the hospital came over just to make sure that they couldn't believe what they were hearing. And as I said, there were water. I drank from a colored water fountain of many a days at that hospital in 60, up to 63. And then as the government began to clamp down on hospitals throughout the South because of all the federal monies coming in, they began to, and I regret I didn't take pictures of those water fountains, those signs, you know?
I took pictures. We lived in Texas at that time. I wasn't used to seeing that. Yeah. Went to Rodeo and went to the bathroom and said whites, colored.
When I speak to children at school now, particularly upper grades, I draw a water line coming in, pipe, and I describe it as pipe, and then I branch off color, and then this one branch off white, and I would tell the kids, now, you see any difference in the water in the two fountains, and they'd sit there for a few minutes, and then somebody would get it, say, well, said, it's all the same water. I said, that's my point. It's all coming in. This one going to the white, this one coming to the black. And I said, the point was, I don't know what they thought was going to happen with everybody drinking out of it, because nobody never touched. The water's coming up, so you never made contact with the spigot or the faucet or whatever it is. And I sit here and I look back over those days and I said, my God, how in the world did we make it through that period, you know? But we prevail. And today I get asked the question, well, why didn't your parents start the civil rights struggle back in the 40s or the 50s or the 20s? And I said, it was just not that my parents' generation and generation before that was not the generation to create that kind of upheaval in the South. And it took the young people of the early 60s, the kids at A&T at the lunchroom counter there, where I give the credit for the first sit-in is in Greensboro. There's some stories about where was the first sit-ins, and I always gave the kids in Greensboro credit for that.
They were from A&T. Mm-hmm. What were the relationships like when you started working between or among the blacks and the whites? Did you feel unwelcome? Did you see outright hostility?
I didn't see any in the medical field, particularly in the Department of Medicine, where, you know, as I said, you know, I talked about, you know, Lou Welt, who's from up north, Chris Fordham and Bill Blythe and Walt Hollander, and a guy named Franklin Williams. They were, you know, despite the fact that they were, particularly the guys from the South, we were treated with the utmost respect in the department. Christmas parties, we were invited, you know, to come. I did not experience any among staff within my job. There were some in other areas, in particular the hospital. You take housekeeping was predominantly black employees and white supervisors back in those days. Dietary was predominantly black. You know, later years, black supervisors were beginning to be hired to supervise employees. I can remember very vividly, we had our own cafeteria in the hospital in the basement. All the employees and black patients and visitors went to that one, and the whites went to the one upstairs. I ate many of meals in the all-black cafeteria back in those days because it was peculiarly marked.
That ended in 63 also?
That ended in the 60s, yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to get on to the integration of Lincoln High School and any involvement you had in it, or if you didn't.
The system.
Do you feel comfortable going
yeah.
on, or do you want
yeah.
to stop?
Yeah. What time do we have?
11:25.
Yeah. We can. Let me just finish up the statement you just asked.
All right.
As I told you, I joined the school system in '69. That was 2 years after they built the high school out on Homestead Road, and my first job assignment under the superintendent then, a guy named Bill Cody, was to go to the high school every morning and work with the white principal and the black principal, who both had come from the segregated black high school and the white high school. The white principal name is Mrs. May Marshbanks, and the black principal, who was my high school principal, Mr. C.A. McDougall. And these two people, these two administrators, had been thrown together without any prior training, any prior orientation.